Coming up on Fronteras, the Central American miners coming to the U.S. are mainly from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Notably absent from this unprecedented exodus are children from the region's poorest country, Nicaragua.
The gangs here are pretty small potatoes compared to what they are in those countries.
Why Nicaraguan children aren't rushing to the U.S. border? ICE is going to start housing women with children at a civil detention center in Karnes County that used to house men. ICE officials say this facility has been renovated to accommodate families.
It allows ICE detainees the freedom of movement, recreational opportunities, consular visitation, while maintaining a safe and secure environment for both the residents and the staff. I'm pretty sure you will agree this is nothing like you've seen before.
We take a tour of what officials are calling a residential center that will be home at least temporarily for female and youth border crossers. First, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is a multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations along the Southwest. I'm Crystal Chavez. Nearly 5 weeks after Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins said North Texas would host 2,000 unaccompanied immigrant children, he announced a change of plans. As KERA's Duali Saikautau reports, Jenkins said the migrants will stay at federal facilities because the number of kids crossing into the U.S. has dropped.
In June, 300 children per day entered Texas illegally. In July, that number dropped by half. And that's the reason, Jenkins said, the U.S. Department's Health and Human Services has decided not to create more temporary sites outside military bases.
The feeling that I have right now is just gratitude to a faith community that stepped up and changed the national conversation from some fear and anger of faceless immigrants and border concerns to changing it to what it is really about, which was desperate children fleeing violence and potentially death, child refugees who needed our help.
The border children will be moved to about 100 shelters operated by the federal government's Office of Refugee Resettlement. Three temporary sites will be on military bases, including Lackland in San Antonio and Fort Sill in Oklahoma. Jenkins said Dallas sites will still pitch in.
Every child will need an attorney to help them through the legal journey here in the U.S., and organizations such as Catholic Charities, the Human Rights Initiative, and the Dallas Hispanic Bar Association are looking for pro bono attorneys and translators to assist with this effort.
It's an effort that Chris Liebram of Texas Baptists supports.
This in no way was a political involvement. This is helping the children. We can't solve the immigration problem. Our concerns are with immigration and with border security, but that's something that's far greater than our assignment. Our assignment was to help the children, and this group came together for that.
Dallas leaders, including Jenkins, plan site visits to the federal facilities in the coming weeks. Duahli Saikautau, KERA News.
Now over to Karnes County, Texas. In the past, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has faced harsh criticisms for conditions at its immigration detention facilities. Now it has unveiled a new kind of center in Karnes County. Officials are calling the center residential rather than detention. While the facility is expected to accept detainees over the next few weeks, ICE opened the doors to the press to see the facility firsthand. TPR's Joey Palacios takes us inside.
Situated in Karnes County, 60 miles southeast of San Antonio, sits the 29-acre Karnes County Residential Center. Previously, it was called the Karnes County Civil Detention Center that housed males apprehended at the border. Now, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, has altered the facility entirely to house women and children. Enrique Lucero is the director of the San Antonio ICE Field Office.
The Karnes County Residential Center is the first facility constructed with ICE new civil detention reforms in mind. It allows ICE detainees the freedom of movement, recreational opportunities, consular visitation, while maintaining a safe and secure environment for both the residents and the staff. I'm pretty sure you will agree this is nothing like you've seen before.
The center resembles a college dormitory, but has the security of a detention facility. At capacity, it can hold 530 women and children. On the side of the complex is a large concourse called the Sally Port. The words welcome and bienvenidos are written on the wall above a door. Inside, the intake center resembles a doctor's waiting room, with a series of desks in the center, and smaller rooms filled with children's toys, and the walls painted with animal caricatures and televisions playing children's shows. In this area, the women and children are processed, allowed to take showers, and are given 6 new sets of clothes.
There will be a Know Your Rights presentation taking place so that residents know their rights as far as immigration rights, their bond rights, their asylum rights. Those will be playing in both English and Spanish language.
There are signs everywhere that officials are trying to make this more of a residential center versus detention. Even the words detention were erased from the outdoor sign on the front of the building. Lucero says all the women and children brought here will be referred to as residents instead of detainees.
Traditionally, you hear as the staff being called guards. Here they are called resident advisors.
Down the hall, they're given medical exams, including physical, dental, optical, and tuberculosis screenings. Lucero says that minors under 18 will be seen within 24 hours by a doctor. Adults will be seen within 7 days.
Generally, that full physical exam happens 14 days within an intake. So there's much more time sensitive for the population that will be in this facility.
Around the residents' living area are 2 courtyards. One will be filled with playground equipment, and the other has a soccer field. It's surrounded by the individual residents' rooms, classrooms, a cafeteria, library, gymnasium, and even a salon.
The residents here have access to this area with freedom of movement from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. every day, freedom of movement. They don't have to be escorted. They can walk in and out of their suites. They can walk in and out of the day rooms.
The residents are provided with phone cards that can be reloaded by family members and have internet access through the library, but are blocked from social media websites like Facebook and Twitter. The cafeteria serves 3 meals per day, and residents over the age of 18 can work either in the cafeteria or in the adjacent beauty salon for $3 per day.
During that time they were working, their children will be provided with child care by a resident advisor.
The children of school age will be provided an education through a San Antonio charter school. In a room close to the library, the women will be able to have video conferences with ICE officials. And while there's a courtroom on site, there's no judge set to be there at this time. The living suites can hold up to 8 people in bunk beds and have private bathrooms.
There may be only one family in a suite. There may be 2 families on the suite. It's really going to depend on the family, how many children, the makeup of those children, the gender of those children.
Lucero says he isn't sure how long a resident will stay at the facility, but through his office, the average length of stay for most people is about 20 days before being released or removed. The center is expected to begin taking detainees this month. The cost to run the facility is around $140 per resident per day. In Karnes County, Joey Palacios, Texas Public Radio News.
Like many children who've crossed the border, Brian Arce is not sure if he'll be able to permanently stay in the U.S. What he is certain about is that living in Honduras has become too dangerous, especially for children. KERA's Stella Chavez sat down with Brian and his mom at their Dallas home. They talked about life back home and the decision to come here.
Brian Arce grew up in a small coastal Honduran town called Arizona. The 14-year-old was mostly raised by his grandmother. His mom left for the U.S. before he was 2. He's been wanting to join her for years, in part because of his neighborhood.
Right next door, there was a man named Rigo who was kind of crazy. My grandmother couldn't take care of me anymore, so my mom sent for me.
Everyone, Brian says, was scared of Rigo. He drank a lot and would get angry and violent. Sometimes he'd throw his own wife out of the house. Nearby, a soccer field had become a battleground.
Every Sunday, people would drink there. Sometimes they'd get into fights, and someone would show up with a gun and start shooting into the air.
Brian's mom, Delmi Arce, says this violence is exactly why she wanted her son to join her in Dallas. When she came to the U.S., it was for economic reasons. She was 18 and traveled with her then-boyfriend. She's 31 now, and they've had 2 more children since they arrived. She says she's grateful Brian survived the trek north.
Thank God I didn't lose my son. Thank God he's with me, but it's hard. It's hard for the parents and the children because they're exposed to a lot of danger. If they stay, they're in danger. If they leave, they're in danger.
Brian's journey late last year wasn't as treacherous as some. He came by bus because his mom didn't want him to walk. The two-week trip took him through Guatemala, El Salvador, and Mexico. He and the coyote, or smuggler, crossed the river on a small inflatable raft. Border Patrol caught him after he tried sneaking around the main road. He was sent to a detention center in Laredo.
Me daba mucho miedo y tristeza también al ver.
I was really scared, and I was sad, because when I got there, I saw a bunch of kids laying on the floor. They just gave us sandwiches. They weren't very good. They gave us water, but it had chlorine in it, and nobody drank it.
Brian spent time in three different centers before transferring to a shelter in Chicago. That place felt more like a school, he says, because the kids were taught things. Learning wasn't always a priority back home. In Honduras, Brian says, some teachers stopped teaching or made fun of students. Now, his mom says he enjoys school. He's headed to ninth grade at J.J. Pierce High this fall.
I told him the school bus would pick him up from home. He said, "Wow, how much is it going to cost?" I told him, "No, there's no cost. The school sends the bus to pick up the children." He was very emotional. Very happy.
Brian and his mom are making up for lost time.
I was so happy because I hadn't seen her in 11 years. I was glad we were finally together.
He's also been reunited with his stepsister, who left Honduras a week before him, and two younger half-siblings he'd never met.
It's very different. Over there, I didn't have my siblings. Now, all of them are here, and I love them very much.
Still, there's a lot of uncertainty. In early July, Brian and his mom went before an immigration judge in Dallas Federal Court. They didn't have an attorney, so they were given more time to find one.
I would like him to stay. I don't know what the decision will be. I think every mother who decides to send their children here doesn't do it to harm them. We do it to protect them.
Brian's next court date is scheduled for October. By then, he'll be deep into his freshman year, learning the language and making new friends. Stella Chavez, KERA News.
So we know minors from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador are heading to this country, but why aren't Nicaraguan kids showing up at our southern border? And what can be learned from that? Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. Since last October, the U.S. Border Patrol has apprehended more than 57,000 children traveling alone from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. Notably absent from this unprecedented exodus from Central America are children from the region's poorest country, Nicaragua. Fronteras reporter Jill Replicle wanted to know why.
Congressman Daryl Issa of VISTA recently traveled to Central America to find out what was driving children to make the dangerous solo journey to the U.S. When he got home, he concluded that the main factor was, quote, severe lack of economic opportunity. But if that's the case, why aren't kids also coming from Nicaragua? Nicaragua is the poorest country in Latin America, only behind Haiti. It borders Honduras to the south, and it shares with El Salvador and Guatemala a history of revolutionary upheaval in the 1970s and 80s.
If you start looking for things that are different, though, take a look at the homicide rate.
Ev Mead is director of the Transborder Institute at the University of San Diego.
It's a gross metric. It's a big oversimplification of the different kinds of violence, but boy, it sticks out.
The murder rate in El Salvador and Guatemala is about four times higher than Nicaragua's. Honduras's murder rate is eight times higher. Central America experts I spoke with and numerous reports suggest that three main things explain why Nicaraguan children aren't flocking to the U.S. border along with their neighbors: the country's relative safety, its effective police force, and its southern neighbor, Costa Rica. We'll get to that last one later. But first, why is crime so much lower in Nicaragua? Experts give the country's police force much of the credit. Tim Rogers runs the online news site Nicaragua Dispatch.
Police have really been very active for a long time at identifying who these kids are that are at risk or are involved in in neighborhood gangs and are making an effort to integrate these kids back into society.
Roger says this is a very different approach than the heavy-handed gang crackdowns that the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras have tried in recent years.
Nicaragua has moved away from that, and so the proof is in the pudding that it's working.
Nicaragua has also managed to keep the violent gangs that operate in other Central American countries from seeping across the border, says Judy Butler. She's a journalist who's lived in Nicaragua for 31 years.
The gangs here are pretty small potatoes compared to what they are in those countries.
Butler says that's in part because of where those gangs first arose, Los Angeles. Immigrants from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala got involved in L.A. street gangs in the 1980s and 90s. And when the U.S. stepped up deportations starting in 1996, criminal deportees took the gangs back to their home countries, but not to Nicaragua. Nicaraguan immigrants lacked the L.A. connection because they mostly settled in Florida and Northern California. Also, Nicaraguans had an easier time staying in the U.S. legally than their Central American neighbors.
Then there were special provisions made in the law for Nicaraguans because they were fleeing an enemy of the United States.
The U.S. opposed the socialist government that seized control of Nicaragua in the late 1970s. It supported the governments of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Mead says that difference in foreign policy trickled down to immigration policy. And it's had difficult consequences for Salvadorans, Guatemalans, and Hondurans.
And it meant that they were much more likely to be deported and much more likely to get on this down cycle where you're spending a lot of money trying to get back into the United States, borrowing money, paying smugglers. But it also means that you have communities in both places where kids grow up without their parents.
Republican and Democratic lawmakers agree that cross-border family ties are one of the main factors drawing Central American kids to the U.S. Nicaragua has weaker ties to the states than its neighbors because there are just a lot fewer Nicaraguans living here. And that brings us back to Costa Rica and Judy Butler.
Nicaragua, just to make sure it's clear, is not exempt from migration. 400,000 Nicaraguans live in Costa Rica, which is about 8% of the total population.
It's much easier for them to get to Costa Rica. It's a porous border.
This is journalist Tim Rogers again.
And Nicaraguans, you know, are sort of the backbone of the Costa Rican economy.
Last week, the presidents of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras met with Barack Obama to talk about how to deal with the flood of children leaving their countries for the U.S. In a joint statement afterwards, the president said they were working on a plan to improve economic opportunities and security conditions in the children's home countries. At least on the security issue, maybe they could learn some lessons from Nicaragua. In San Diego, I'm Jill Replogle.
Last week, we heard about solar power in Texas. Now we turn our attention to wind. Commercial wind turbines stand more than 100 feet tall, with blades nearly as long. The wind turbines developed by engineers at the University of Texas at Arlington are a bit smaller. As part of KERA's Breakthrough series, Lauren Silverman reports on the micro windmills, which are tinier than an ant.
Let me show you. This one has a magnifier.
In a cold lab room at UT Arlington, electrical engineering professor J.C. Chow is showing off a windmill. It's mounted on a grain of white rice.
Because it's so small, we have to use tweezer.
The micro windmill is a tiny speck of metal with a rectangular base and three shiny metal blades the size of ant antennae.
Just to think about this way, my interest and my research focus is to shrink things.
The windmills aren't for a science fiction project. They're meant to harvest the power of the wind and deliver small bursts of energy to compact devices like remote sensors or cell phones. Smitha Rao is a university research associate who came up with the design for the tiny turbines.
We visualized that we could have a panel of these outside to power your outdoor lighting. And as I was talking to Dr. Chow, I was waving my hands, and he was like, guess what else you can use it for? To charge your cell phone.
That's right. A sleeve connected to your phone's battery would have the windmills stuck on top.
So theoretically, if you wave your hand enough, then you should be able to generate some power to send that one important text message.
Creating windmills with parts a fraction of the diameter of a human hair was a real challenge. Rao says at first the blades just weren't spinning with her original flat design. That's when she noticed something about her daughter's pinwheel.
And I realized that it had this curved structure that made it rotate much faster, even when she was just barely waving it. And I said, that's what I need to do. I need to create that artificial curvature for the wind to make it move faster.
The problem was in trying to create that curvature on such a minute scale from two-dimensional metal pieces. So Rao teamed up with a Taiwanese electromechanical fabrication company, experimenting with a new layering process. It was a success. The nickel alloy blades aren't curved, but they have a step-like structure that appears smooth and helps with rotation.
How much wind does it take to move these things?
It doesn't take much. The reason is that the blade has almost no weight. We blow on it, it will turn already. So that's why we are so optimistic.
These could be tucked under a bridge or on city streets, places where sun doesn't shine and a traditional wind tower can't fit. A lot of people think small is weak, but Chow says going small can mean less waste, lower cost, and more efficiency. That's why engineers across the country are developing micro-electromechanical systems, or MEMS devices, for applications in energy, medicine, and transportation. Still, there are concerns unique to miniature mechanics.
Oh, well, for the big windmill, the moisture is not an issue. You can rain and the windmill still work. But for our device, moisture is a major issue. When it's very humid, the water molecule may go into the 1 micron, 2 micron gap and become glue and glue it, so it won't move at all.
So water becomes glue, and a speck of dust is like a boulder. Chow and Rao are still optimizing the mechanics of the windmills. Then they hope to see them in action, maybe harvesting energy to recharge your cell phone. Lauren Silverman, KERA News.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region and immigration. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. Find the entire audio for this program and past shows at tpr.org under the Programs tab. Share these stories with your friends on social media with our one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. Charanga Cakewalk composed this theme music. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.